Welcome to Drugs and Ireland, the Citizens' Assembly, a podcast hosted by Paul McAuliffe and Breage McOscar, produced by Fianna Fáil ahead of the Citizens' Assembly on Drugs. This is episode 2, The Impact.
I'm delighted to be joined by three fantastic people who are going to help us understand the impact of drugs on communities and families. First of all, we're joined by Jack Nolan, former Assistant Commissioner with An Garda Síochána. You're very welcome, Jack.
Thanks very much, Paul.
We've Dr. Denise Proudfoot, the Assistant Professor in the DCU School of Nursing and the lead investigator on the dual diagnosis report, a community perspective. And we also have Maureen Penrose, who has a lifetime of experience in the Family Support Network and I suppose direct experience of addiction in families and has worked with many people who've gone through that process. So I'm delighted to have all of you here today, guys.
Thank you. Hello.
So look, I suppose this is such a big area. I think what we'd like to do maybe, Jack, is just talk a little bit about we've talked about the scale of the problem already. I want to talk about how the guards feel that on the ground, and there's a lot of responsibility that falls on the Gardaí from a criminal justice perspective to be the solution to everything, but there's a much bigger issue here at play. It's a bigger societal response that's needed, isn't there?
Yeah, I think you're touching off some very interesting points there, Paul. I suppose since the early 1970s, and indeed slightly before that, we've had the so-called war on drugs. We've had a criminal justice model for dealing with the drug problem on a global basis, in fact, not just in Ireland. But I suppose from 1977 onwards, as the drug epidemics that were prevalent and visible to many people in Dublin's inner city resulted in the creating of the 1977 Misuse of Drugs Act. And that has been the primary legislation that has guided An Garda Síochána and guided An Garda Síochána's approach from one dimension for the last 50 odd years. I joined An Garda Síochána in 1977 myself, so I have lived through the whole evolution of the whole approach to drugs in this country, from the very earliest days of the heroin epidemic in the inner city to provincial towns beginning to experience the same problems with drugs in communities to the extent that every division in An Garda Síochána now throughout the entire country has a dedicated drugs unit. Has that approach worked? I think it has worked in some respects. It has, what you would say, helped contain the problem. It hasn't eradicated the problem. I think today, and I think you're quoted yourself in some dull speeches of saying, if you walk outside the doors of indeed this studio we're in, it wouldn't take any of us very long to purchase drugs. I think if we look at the global scale of the seizures of drugs, it increases incrementally year on year. There was a pause during COVID-19 when the supply chains were interrupted, but those supply chains are back in full operation now. And the cocaine pipeline from South America to Europe, sometimes with Ireland as a key transit point, indeed the US Department of Homeland Security has indicated that Ireland is a transit point to the UK. We see Belgium and Holland now being designated as the key distribution points for Europe. The drug market in Europe is probably the most lucrative market anywhere in the world, surpassing even the United States. We know that the United States continues to suffer continual problems, again with the importation from South America via Mexico and all the cartels that exist. And what it all leads to is money. Huge amount of money awash in on a global basis, and an inability of governments, an inability of global institutions, or indeed possibly a lack of willingness to tackle how that money is being invested, where it's being invested, or how it's being invested. In Ireland, as we all know, with the shooting of Veronica Guerin, that ignited a whole legislative response, which enhanced the various Misuse of Drugs Acts, and brought CAB, the Criminal Assets Bureau, into existence in 1996, the Criminal Assets Bureau Act. And what that had was a temporary flight, almost like a flight of drug lords out of the country for a period of time, and then they get replaced. And it's a never increasing cycle. When one gang is dismantled, heir apparents rise quickly. We saw it with the Dunn family from the inner city. We saw it with the Cahill family coming to prominence. We saw it with the Gilligan family replacing them. And as we know nowadays, we have seen both the Hutch and Kinahan families emerge to the forefront. And indeed, the Kinahans have gone to the very top of the global scale in relation to transnational organised crime.
You're describing, Jack, you're describing an industry, a global industry, akin to the scale of a multinational company. You know, like this is something that many governments have struggled with. I suppose the question is that the ordinary guard on the beat is the one that's interacting with the person who is at the bottom of that supply chain. The communities that Maureen and myself and many people are from are the people who are at the end of that supply chain. How can the guards respond to that global industry, or can they?
Well, they can, they have to, and they are, in my opinion. And if you look at that industry, you can see it in a pyramid shape. You have these top-end cartels at the very apex of it. You have then the suppliers, the growers, the contractors further down the line. Then you get the middlemen, and eventually you get to the street dealers. And beneath that, you have the users, the unfortunate people who are at the end of the food chain. They're the people who become marginalised. Many of them come from disadvantaged areas, disadvantaged communities. And indeed, many of them are disadvantaged individuals, both within their own fractured communities and within their own families. And what can the guards do about it? I think there has been an awakening in law enforcement, not just in Ireland, but on a global basis, that a criminal justice approach alone will not suffice. There has to be, and we hear a lot about it, community engagement. But only through community engagement, in really face-to-face, coordinated and targeted approaches. You may or may not know, I do some work in the Darndale area. Again, it's a symptom, it's an example of a community that has suffered from the ravages of drugs. There are many other communities around Dublin City and around our country who suffer in the same way. But it's only through the marrying of all the skill sets of the various agencies, not just the policing problem. The police can deal with the sale, supply, and indeed the possession. And we see, you know, on average, in or around 22 to 25,000 drug-related offences go through our courts. An examination of Garda annual reports will show that figure is, you know, unusually pretty constant. When I was working here in Dublin City and in charge of Dublin City, I'd see for Dublin 10,000 drug offences every year. And I have often said at joint police committees, I'm not sure is this an indicator of success or an indicator of failure. We don't really know. We're getting the people at the bottom end of the scale. And then if you move farther up the food chain, on Garda Síochána seizes roughly 35 to 40 million euros worth of drugs every year. The revenue and customs seize about another 40 odd thousand. So that's 80 million euros worth of drugs seized. And taking the rule of thumb that's generally applied in law enforcement in relation to the drug interdictions, it's usually one tenth. So that tells us the Irish market is in or around 800 million to a billion euros, which is an interesting figure when you compare it to the media estimates of the wealth of the Kinahan organised crime grouping. That's somewhere in the region of 1 billion as well. Yeah. That's probably just a fraction of the overall profit and gain that individual gangs have made. So what can the individual guard do? The individual guard has to keep doing what they've always done: encourage, engage, meet people, refer people, and indeed, where dealing is concerned, follow, prosecute, and bring people before the courts.
Maureen, Jack describes the scale of it, and he also talks about the communities that are impacted by it. I'm sometimes afraid to even mention those communities. I know I'm from Finglas, and sometimes when we talk about drug addiction in our area, it kind of adds to the stigma of our own area. And in those communities, there are people who want to take a really strong law and order approach and, you know, get rid of the drug dealers. And I suppose that would have been something that in the very early days of the drugs marches, that was the approach. And yet you have people from within that community that are the victims of this industry and whose addiction is being preyed on. Can you tell us a little bit more in about the impact on those communities and on those families as individuals? Because we talk about them as statistics sometimes.
Yeah, I suppose I look at my community, and I'm from Blanchardstown, and a lot of communities are affected, and some are more visibly affected than others. So my community of Blanchardstown, I feel, has been kind of let down. And that it's a community then that's wounded. And it's very well known that people who take drugs, particularly when they go on to become addicted to drugs, it's because it suits a wound they have. It makes them feel better. It helps them fit in. It eases their pain, emotional trauma pain, pain of not fitting in through spectrum disorders that are not addressed, because you could wait till you're going to university to have a spectrum disorder assessed. So I feel the communities have been let down. So in communities, the more the community has been let down, the higher the drug use rate in those communities. That's my opinion. So socially deprived and victimised and neglected areas. And that's been going since well before the 70s when the heroin came to town. But the mistakes at that time with the heroin were that nothing was done at the start. It was 20 years before there was a real effort to address that problem. And here we are now, and I've been at a local meeting where somebody from the HSE, I asked them, well, what are we going to do? There's crack rising here, and it's rising and rising, and we're talking 4 years, maybe 5 years into it now. What are we doing about that? Oh, well, Maureen, that's unfortunate because we don't have any methadone for crack. Now, what sort of a patronising answer to a question? And really, literally, we're sitting on our hands again, waiting for another epidemic to hit our little communities and our children and our grandchildren.
Do you think then, Maureen, those communities are ready for a change in approach?
Yes.
One that separates maybe the users away from the criminal justice system? Or like, are they ready to try something new, do you think?
Well, I don't think you should punish people because they're hurt and they're medicating themselves. Mm. That's my opinion. I suppose I've seen people who've been butchering themselves with needles, and I've heard their stories of how that happened and how they grew up and what their hurts are. And there's quite a substantial number of people who were clients in the community drug services whose parents were in industrial schools. And I'd love to see a piece of research done on that, because their parents were hurt. And I've spoken to parents who say, I don't know how to love my kids because I never got that.
And I think, Maureen, that's one of the things I think people in the Citizens Assembly, one of these concepts that everyone's going to have to learn, and many people understand it, that are in the communities. But the idea of trauma is really, really important, isn't it? Because
yes.
I remember it being described to me as someone, if somebody has a headache, they'll take 2 Panadol. Yeah. If someone has the pain of trauma, yeah, then one of the ways that they can ease that pain is with self-medicating with illegal drugs.
Whether it be alcohol.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of people medicating themselves with alcohol. It's not that people say, oh, I have this trauma, I must get some heroin. It's that there's a lot of drug availability in the community, so people try it. And some people just say, honey, I'm home. This stops my heart. This helps me to live. This helps me to talk to people.
And Bridget's question is, for the man or woman who's living in a house and outside their house every day, dealing is going on, and they just want to get rid of the dealing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they're ready for drugs being dealt with in a different way? Like the term decriminalisation, I think, we haven't really finally landed on what that is. But like, do you think some sort of regime which doesn't penalise addiction, are communities like yours, like mine, are they ready for that?
Well, I think they're ready for something that does work. The war on drugs is 50 years old now, and drugs are, hands down, they're winning, do you know? So it's time to have another look. There are studies and evidence to show that inclusion of people in their community drug services, welcoming people back into their community, building their self-esteem, teaching them how to heal their hearts. They're the things that work. And we take a community, we take a child that's born, what supports are there? If we take a child that's acting out with ADHD at 3, what supports are there? we need to kind of start at the beginning. We need to have a playing field where people can recover.
So am I hearing you from your mind that you'd like the Citizens Assembly to touch on all of those broader societal points as well as just the issue
it's not going to happen unless we do. Yeah. We really need to look at how society is treating people.
Denise, I might bring you in there. Mm-hmm. I suppose the another concept I think that is there for people to learn about is the idea of dual diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And how mental health directly impacts the issue of addiction. For somebody who hasn't come across the term dual diagnosis, can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Okay, Paul. So essentially, dual diagnosis, I suppose a formal definition is it's the kind of coexistence of mental health and substance misuse problems for an individual. And it's like, well, what does that mean in real language, in sort of plain language that people can understand? So it's really somebody may be experiencing something like depression or anxiety and an addiction. So it could be alcohol use or drug use. And often when we talk about dual diagnosis, it's a kind of a chicken and egg situation. Which comes first? So is it that somebody was depressed and they started maybe to drink a lot, or they started using drugs, as Maureen said, and sometimes it's availability, it's within their social circle, or is it due to maybe an alcohol or drug problem that their mental health deteriorates? So the term dual diagnosis, it's contested. People in the field aren't very comfortable with it really as a term, but really it's a combination of addiction or a mental health issue. And I think the thing about dual diagnosis is important, it's a continuum. So we're talking right across the spectrum of society. So Maureen has referred there, and Jack, to, you know, within communities where there, you know, there's a lot of drug use and a lot of poverty. So that, what we term intersectionality. So there's a combination of issues. You have poverty, unemployment, drug use, availability of drugs. So that would be aspect. You know, so dual diagnosis can be quite prominent in that. And then you have people maybe in other social classes, maybe where they're, you know, due to work stress or marital or relationship difficulties, they start to maybe use alcohol or use drugs recreationally, and then it's the combination. And just to pick up on what Maureen said there about trauma, I mean, that's a huge right across, and particularly in mental health settings, you know, not just with addiction, but increasingly we're now acknowledging trauma. And for a lot of people, they don't know they're traumatised, which Maureen said. So it could be, you know, maybe in their 20s or maybe in their 30s that they actually start to connect and actually realise that some of this is due to trauma, maybe back to childhood issues, difficulties in their family.
And Denise, could you tell us about the principle of no wrong door?
Yeah, so really when in the research we did in Finglas and Cabra, it was this concept, who's responsible for people with dual diagnosis. So they tend to rotate. So these are people who at times are in crisis. They present maybe to an A&E or to a Garda station with a family member, and then say, well, maybe go to, you know, it's the wrong A&E, for example. It might be Blanchestown. You need to go to the Mater, for example, if it was in Dublin. But that's a general hospital setting. So you have somebody who's maybe withdrawing and somebody who maybe is suicidal. So they're kind of presenting into the wrong place. So the one, the no wrong door really is that wherever they present, people can respond. So it's not that you're going to have necessarily specialists in every type of setting, but that health professionals, social care professionals can respond and actually and recognise this is possibly dual diagnosis that's going on. For a long time, they've been pushed from one to the next. So do they belong in mental health services or do they belong in addiction services? So Finglas Addiction Support Team, which I'm part of the board there, they, you know, for an example, they would say that a lot of the clients they're meeting have dual diagnosis. So people don't necessarily, a bit like trauma, they don't necessarily know that they have it. But the problem with somebody seeking help for dual diagnosis in an addiction service is you don't have that mental health perspective and that understanding. So there is certainly, there's been some more developments in the HSE recently. So we now have developments around kind of clinical pathways about that. So that is quite positive, but it's still at a pilot level. It needs to be, you know, I suppose, increased pace. So if I present, or somebody or a family member presents with depression or anxiety, and there is a complication, it can be dealt with. So when somebody has cancer and diabetes, we don't say to them, oh, well, you need to sort out your cancer first and then we can treat your diabetes. And another thing that Maureen brought up, I think, is that issue around stigma as well. So families, you know, and when we talk about communities, these are real people. These are families. These are regular people who are affected by this. So their parents, there are their children, their lots of relatives. So it's a whole family effect as well. So the research we did was with community. So it was a mix. So it was the families, the service users, the people who seek help, and some of the local organisations that support them. So really, dual diagnosis is quite complex. I think one thing I'd like to refer to really is the kind of policy documents do recognise it. So we've got sharing the vision, which is the mental health policy, and then reducing harm, supporting recovery, which is the drug policy. They both now are acknowledging dual diagnosis and it needs to be responded. So it's complex, but so are lots of other social and care issues. Addiction is complex. Mental health is complex.
I suppose like the key to all that is that addiction is an illness in and of itself, whether it's coincidental with another form of illness. And I think probably the challenge for us if we change our policy is whether or not the state actually has those wraparound supports in place for users who are maybe diverted away from the criminal justice system. And I suppose from what you're saying, probably just not there yet, but
there'll be a lot of people who I think will be in the Citizens Assembly and they'll find it hard to get their head around the idea that addiction is an illness.
Mm-hmm.
They'll think it's a choice. What would you say to that point, Denise?
Well, I mean, I think the evidence, you know, that in a sense it might be a choice to start using drugs in the first, you know, so it's within your peer group, you're 18, 19, it's fun, you know, we get, you know, but it's what we're talking about is this problem, drug use. And so in a sense, it's when it starts to affect all aspects of life. You can't go to college, you can't study, your relationship, you're having difficulty with relationships, maybe with your parents, and, you know, all of that. So it's that combination. So that's where it starts to impact a lot on your life. So you're not functioning as you would like. So I suppose.
And the reward system in your brain, the pathways, they all change when you get into chronic drug use or alcohol use.
Yeah. So we have to think, you know, so it is drug and alcohol. So we're kind of, you know, and when we talk about these clients, you know, they're different people and they're the same, you know what I mean? And they're, as I say, I think it's really important, they're from across society.
And I suppose that's an interesting point as well, is that a lot of people have alcohol dependency, but they're not interacting with the criminal justice system in the way that people maybe who have problems with heroin or cannabis do.
And Jack, do you think that I think that brings us back to this point, and I think no matter what the Citizens Assembly discuss, it will come back to that idea of it is illegal to use those substances. Do you think it's difficult for the guard on the beat or for somebody who's looking at this, at the industry that you're talking about, to understand these concepts of addiction and illness? Or do you think that they're well understood by guards who have to make those practical decisions on the ground?
Well, I would hope that they're well understood by guards anyway. And I mean, there's an extensive emphasis on training and about both mental health and other illnesses that can affect an individual. That it's not just a deviant act when somebody breaks a window in Capel Street or somewhere and a patrol car arrives and you have somebody who's a problematic drug user, who is homeless, who has illnesses or other addictions, and suddenly the question is, well, what do you do with them? Is a police station, a cell in a police station, the most suitable place for somebody who is a very fractured, a very vulnerable individual? My own sense is it's not the best place. It should be the last resort to put somebody into a cell who's suffering from a range of illnesses. And what Denise has talked about is starting a small model in Dublin, law enforcement, assisted recovery, operated through the Annalifi Drug Project. I'm on the board of it. It's a small project building on experiences in other major cities such as Vancouver and Toronto in Canada. And there is a need for serious consideration of how a model or a similar model as that can be applied across Dublin City, where the majority of the problems, as we know, happen. That's not denigrating problems in other areas, but that's where most of the problems manifest themselves, first of all. I'd like to see a pilot or an expanded development of the Annalifi Law Enforcement Assisted Recovery Project. But for the young...
Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, it started out as a case management project that Maureen is probably pretty familiar with from down in the Store Street area, where somebody who had a homeless, drug problem, other addiction problems, and a range of maybe Garda warrants in existence for their arrest. And by and large, what would happen is the warrant would be executed, the person would be arrested, they had no a long record of previous convictions, and they would be imprisoned in Mountjoy Prison or somewhere else like that. And they would go back into an environment where that, with the, all due respects to everybody involved, is it not a drug-free environment either, and where people can access drugs. That's these are the realities of the state and the country that we live in this day and age. But with the law enforcement assisted recovery model, there is an effort made to get them treatment, identify them, get them into the daycare centres, and then at the same time engage with An Garda Síochána so that all their warrants can be dealt with on one individual day at one individual sitting before a judge who is fully acquainted with all of the aspects of the case, and the proper approach to treatment for that individual then can be identified. And then sometimes this comes down to just getting somebody out of homelessness into either sheltered accommodation, first of all. But if we want an example, and we need to go and look, and we've all heard about the Portuguese model. It's in existence since 2001. I've been to Lisbon, I've looked at it. But what they did was they put the emphasis on treatment as distinct from imprisonment or incarceration, yeah. Just like Maureen and just like Denise have said. But they expanded the services.
Yeah.
Which that is the key for us. We can switch from a law enforcement model to a rehabilitation treatment model. That's a policy issue. But we have to invest and have the services that can enable the support to exist that prevent the relapses into the criminal justice approach.
So resources and services have to be as equal a part in the list of recommendations as the kind of headline issues. Yeah.
I think so, Paul. And I know that the Department of Health are considering this, the Department of Justice are considering this, but it requires a commitment to change our approach and invest in the new approach to give it a chance to succeed. And then maybe we won't have as many people with multiple issues surfacing in our communities and in a vulnerable situation that they can be preyed upon by people who will continue to supply them with illicit products.
Maureen, I see you nodding your head.
I am. Well, I mean, I worked in a community drug team for 18 years, and the community-based approach was great because people felt accepted by their own community and cared for and cared about by their own community, and reconnection and reintegration is a very important thing. But we need, I mean, there's gaps. People come in, they take ages to get into rehabilitation service, they take ages to finally get drug free, and then they're criminalised already, there's no drug jobs available for them. So we need to have, and Portugal has that model where there's jobs available also. So we need to have a model where people are cared about, brought into the fold, their self-worth is raised so that they feel that they can actually do something for their lives. The services are there to look after them, and that they have possibilities and hope for a future.
Denise?
Yeah. Just on what Maureen was said, and I suppose something I think when you discuss about drugs and addiction and in the kind of contemporary sense is this concept of recovery as well.
Because we should champion recovery much more, shouldn't we?
Yeah. But I mean, it's a huge, you know, people who are in recovery who are working, and a lot of them are working in drug agencies and part of community. They're a huge resource, and that peer-to-peer thing is really, really powerful. So you have to admire people. So they've had their own struggles, their own journey. You know, they're now in recovery. And we talk about stigma again, and it's quite challenging to work in this world as well. But that peer thing is really, really important. I think it's a really any developments and any kind of service development treatment has to kind of be built on that peer model. So, you know, talking to somebody who's been through a similar thing, and I mean, it gives hope. It's a role model. I mean, I think it's really powerful for.
And we've done a lot over September in. Communities right across country with Recovery Month.
Yeah.
I know the Recovery Walk down O'Connell Street is, I took part in that 1 year. It's a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
But I suppose that's about showing people that while we're talking about drug addiction here, that there is light at the other end. I suppose my question is, Maureen, and for all three of you, do you think people who have come through recovery would be fearful of supply, that availability of supply? Because we saw in the American system when when they talked about decriminalising, they basically threw it to the market and let the market, they taxed it and let the market expand. Mm-hmm. I suppose the fear is it incompatible to have that message of recovery and also talking about the possibility of decriminalising but not legalising, if that makes sense? Do you know the point I'm making, Maureen?
Yeah, well, my thoughts are around decriminalisation or decriminalisation of possession for one's own use. Mm-hmm. I think there are different levels of criminality and different levels of drug use. So that's my thing. I don't know, I'm talking sort of as, say, a mother that looked at a child and looked at a child trying to put a hand into a bag of crisps and couldn't get it. And the sadness, you see, and the loss of future and the loss of dreams that you see. And you just, as a parent, as a family member of somebody who takes drugs, you just want to scream, why is nobody really making this an emergency and getting it done? Because we have meetings and we set up plans, but they take months. You have a meeting once a month to try and organise this plan. Where's the emergency? It's you know, there are a lot of things happening in the lower waged communities, I suppose, that are not emergencies. Social,
maybe they're not priorities, Maureen.
Yes, yeah. They're not priorities.
And I think when you...
We know we're not priorities, you know.
When you think of other types of addictive behaviour like gambling, I mean, that is, you know, it's very accessible. You know, so it, in a sense, it doesn't mean... But lots of people don't gamble, you know what I mean? Well, so
that's a good question, yeah. I suppose. So is there space, because I think people are very divided in this issue, is there space for safe drug use that we should permit or should tolerate? I know we talk a lot about addiction, but there might be non-problematic users as there are with alcohol and gambling. And do you think is that the case with drugs? Mm.
If I could come in there, Breach. I suppose we have seen some developments in with regards to safe drug use in the fact of supervised injection facilities. Yes. I personally have seen them in Toronto, seen them in operation. Very clinical settings. I've heard all the fears about the neighbourhoods being inundated with pushers, etc. I've walked those neighbourhoods. I don't see it. We had the legislation passed in this country, and we have the proposed facility hasn't happened yet. But that's one aspect of safe drug use. We have in our nightclubs, in our music venues, in our dance venues. There is rampant drug use among recreational drug users. And they take that in as safe a fashion as is possible because they're self-regulating themselves in the amount they take, by and large. And we don't have mass deaths or anything like that at our entertainment venues. Will a community today in 2022 in Ireland be able to accept that? I'm not sure. It remains a difficult, complex problem in the fact that drugs could possibly be legally available to anybody, and a recovering problematic drug user would have the added temptations of it. But what is not working is the criminalization of people who take drugs. That has to be addressed in one form or another. Life chances, career chances, and opportunities for generations have been damaged since the early 1970s. And we have to address that problem sooner, whether it's by regulation and sale through pharmaceutical outlets, etc., whether it's decriminalization, but the individuals have to be decriminalized out of the justice system. Mm. Police stations and prisons are not the place for people with problematic drug issues.
Yeah. Denise, is there scope for safe use?
I think there's an argument for it, certainly. And I mean, and back to Jack's comment. Yes, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who, you know, function. You know, when you think about sort of the classic definitions of addictions is that, you know, it takes over your life. So you can't function, you can't go to work, you can't study, you know, normal family. So, I mean, I think it depends. It often comes down to the actual drug that people are using. And if sometimes it's the combination, I suppose what the term was known as polydrug use. So where somebody's maybe injecting as well and they're also taking tablets and potentially alcohol. So I suppose it's that fine line between what's legal and maybe it's that what disturbs people. So I think people still struggle with people injecting. you know, but maybe there's a sense, well, it's okay for me to have a bottle of Prosecco at home, you know what I mean? Or, do you know,
people might be uncomfortable with you equating those two drugs.
Yes, I'm not...
It's a really interesting comparison because one is legal and one is illegal, but they're both drugs.
And I think that's something that the citizens, they have to explore this, you know. It's uncomfortable sometimes, and it's, you know, sometimes it's about knowledge, and it's also getting comfortable in this space. Yeah. But that is the society we live in, and some of the things have been legal for many, many years.
Could I ask you sort of one final question? If there's one recommendation or one area that you'd like the Citizens Assembly to focus on, I know for other Citizens Assemblies, you know, 30, 40, 50 recommendations. Is there one area that you don't want to get lost in all of the recommendations? Maureen?
Well, community woman here. The community's had a big involvement 20 years ago with the setting up of the drugs task forces, and that was working very well. But then I suppose things became about numbers and number crunching and input and output and data. And I suppose the HSE values their funding or evaluates their funding and what they give out by that. So I did have a chat with someone one day, and they were talking about treatment interventions and, you know, just with somebody who's dropping into a local community drug project. And I was saying, well, what about the making people feel valued? What about building their self-esteem? What about making them feel safe? What about making them motivated towards? And he said, no, we don't count. We don't count any of that. That's not counted. So I think we should go back to counting that. I think we should go back to valuing that. And of course, we have to watch the money and where it's going and how it's used, and we value for money. But let's get the community approach.
Because there's a lot of solutions in the community already.
Yeah.
Jack, is there one area you'd like
to... Yeah, absolutely, Paul. I think the message that has to be got across is we must get the message out to our young people, and I mean our very young people, that all drugs are bad. They're not good for you in any format. And people have to be educated to understand the dangers, the risks, the hurt, the pain, and the fear that comes with being a drug user. And we have to get that message out that there are alternatives. And it has to start with our young children in primary school, secondary school, and right up the line. And for an example, if we take a look at road deaths in Ireland in the 1980s, was 850 on an annual basis. It's now somewhere around 130 to 140. So it can be done with education, training, and information.
That's a really good point. And Denise, the last one with you.
Yeah. I think for me, you know, that these people matter. So when somebody has an addiction, and particularly obviously my interest is in dual diagnosis, that they can get the right care, that it's evidence-based, and we can invest in that. So, you know, and whatever community somebody comes from, you know, that they get the effective care and that they have hope. I think so. It's about the approach that you take. But I think it's about investing and also making use of, you know, the experience that we have as, you know, within the communities, within the health service and the social care service to actually treat, because, as I say, these people matter. And I think that's really important.
It's a really positive note to finish on. Maureen, Denise, Jack, thank you so much for taking part in it. I think it'll be an invaluable resource for those people who are considering these issues. Thank you. And so we look forward to you joining us next Sunday for our final episode with Jim O'Callaghan and Anna Quigley, who will speak about the Citizens Assembly, the process and the political challenges.
You've been listening to Drugs and Ireland, the Citizens Assembly, a podcast hosted by Paul McAuliffe and Breed McOscar, produced by Fianna Fáil and recorded at the podcast studio. Thank you.